asses. You get a lot of
Log Talk Radio.
Oh, shit.
What in the...
You did not.
I wonder if it's going to auto-play the music now.
Yeah, pause that music.
Oh my god, it's not going to let me.
We'll just...
Wow.
I'll edit this part out somehow. I'll edit it out somehow.
I wonder if we're on. I'm checking the comments to see if people can actually hear us. This is hilarious in a bad way.
I think we are. It usually says, you know, has a if there's a timer on the dashboard, that means you're on. And it clicks down.
Yeah, who knows? All right, so if you're listening live, can you just drop a link in the comments to see if we've actually you've been hearing us since the start of the show 3 months ago? Let's just keep going.
Yeah. Well, you know, like you were saying, it was a long game. That's what happens when Brian Hoyer throws 50 passes. You're going to get a lot of incompletions, and you're going to, especially when you're down 41-0, and you're trying to score points, and you're kicking the ball off again, and you draw out something that's a lot longer than ever needs to go on. Now, I didn't see the play at all live, and I went back and watched the replay, and it was pretty bad looking. Like, it looked like hostile whenever that guy sits in the chair and the bad guy flips the back of his foot open and he gets up and tries to run out the door and he steps and the whole thing rips in half. That's exactly what looked like with Foster. He just stepped and his whole Achilles just was a whoopee cushion. And I think the kind of the silly part about the play is they turn through a screen and Nate Washington on the other side. And of course he drops it in the goal line, which is just the most Nate Washington thing to ever happen.
Yeah. I think there was pretty much general knowledge about what happened and what was hurt. I mean, I think even, the commenters nailed it pretty quickly that it definitely looked like Arian tore his Achilles because that's what it looked like from the beginning. It was just, I've seen many people say, one of my all-time favorite players, and that's right. I mean, there are very few running backs who move like Arian Foster, who glide, who are just beautiful running the ball. I mean, he's just it's a work of art for him when he runs, the vision and those sorts of things. So it was heartbreaking. You pretty much knew what happened, and then it's not hard to make the conclusion that hey, we're not going to pay him. I think he's owed $7 million next year, coming off a explosion sapping injury like that. It's just heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. And we'll touch about. Touch on like his long-term longevity here in a second. But let's talk about immediate future right now and this season. And like we said, Monday, the news came out, they did the MRI, Foster's out for the year. And so, BFT, how is Arian Foster's absence going to affect this offense going forward for the rest of this slog of the season?
Well, I don't really know at this point. I mean, let's just be honest here, that teams have been stacking the box against Brian Hoyer. Foster struggled to run. He's definitely not a 3 yards per carry guy. Even at this stage of his career, he is not a 3 yards per carry guy. Foster is one of the best in the league at picking up the blitz. He's one of the best in the league at catching the ball in the backfield. We'll miss those two aspects quite a bit. But, it's already kind of a nightmare offense, and now you've just got no upside from your running back position. Alfred Blue, no, he's just a guy. He is replacement level. Chris Polk has a little go to him. Jonathan Grimes can come in, fullback Jonathan Grimes, as he was called all game on Sunday, which was just hilarious.
I was going to say, he's as much of a fullback as Jay Proch is.
Pretty much. But he'll be able to play some of the passing down. Polk can play the passing downs as well. But we've gone from having our second best skill position player is now gone. And on a team that absolutely lacks in explosive talent, it's just another check in the we're screwed box.
Mm-hmm. And I think the only thing that you kind of left out was Brian Hoyer is really bad, but he's even worse when he doesn't have any type of running game. And we talked about our season preview. I know I wrote about my season preview, just the numbers that Hoyer had in Cleveland whenever the run game went to hell when Mack was injured. And, I mean, he was two different quarterbacks. And so you thought Brian Hoyer's been bad so far. Just wait until you have Chris Polk, Alfred Blue, and Grimes, you're wearing the ball a ton, if they ever get to play a competitive football game ever again. And so it's going to be something else to watch out for. We're going to have even more importance and more reliance on Brian Hoyer at the quarterback position, which is exactly what this, team did not want heading into the season.
Yeah, right. The entire goal was to run the ball first and play great defense.
And win close games, like O'Brien said last year, even though that's not a sustainable strategy. But in the long term, you touched on it briefly. Foster's cap hit next year is $9.3 million. And they cut him, they save $7 million. And they'll have dead money of $2 million, but obviously $7 million is a lot more than $2 million. And this will put them around $120 million at the salary cap. And the cap will probably jump up again next year. But at the moment, if the cap stays the same at $143, Houston will be about $23 million below the cap if they cut Foster after the season. And so BSD, with all the holes in the roster, the lack of, even though there's the lack of running back depth, do you think this was Foster's last snap as a Houston Texan for the rest of his career?
I think that's it. Unless we bring him back, we're not going to have him back in 2016. I just don't see it happening. There are too many holes to fill. There are too many 31, 32-year-old players over the hill who we're going to sign for $7, $8 million that we have to go get to plug holes, and they're going to suck like Vince Wilfork. But this, there's too many holes right now. He's not going to be re-signed. And the worst part of all is, if he would have torn his ACL, at least you can it's a solid year. You get that year in, and you've got most of that explosiveness back. The Achilles injuries really sap the explosiveness for a good 2 years, or it takes about 2 years to fully recover from them. And Foster's already 30 years old. So I think he's even going to have a hard time finding something out there for next year. It'll probably be a veteran's minimum deal, because he's going to have to teams that he's got the giddy up back. He's already a step slow. He was good enough as a running back to be a step slow, but I don't think he's good enough and has that elite athleticism at this point to be two or three steps slow.
And I mean, as far, I don't know anything about, I've never hurt my Achilles, but it seems like that's something, it'd be an issue whenever you go to cut. And then you, after you make that, your cut with your left foot, and then you bounce off that right foot and reaccelerate. It seems like that give won't be there anymore. And, it's a big issue for Foster. He's never been very good in the power run scheme. And so he has played outside zone. And if he can't cut back, that's a huge issue. And I agree, too. I think this is, Foster's last snap, at least for, next year. They're probably going to come next season. They'll save the cap room. And I think the more interesting idea, too, is kind of like how you talked about with Schaub, where you said Kubiak's kind of unraveling was never taking any risk on any quarterbacks, never having any type of backup plan with Schaub one bit. And then whenever he went in 2013 happened, so did Kubiak and the entire regime. And obviously this is not as dramatic with the position running back, but I think it's the same sort of thing where Houston never had any type of backup plan at running back at all. They just used backup guys. They've used late picks, sixth round picks, seventh round picks. They never had like another, other than Ben Tate, who kind of fell off the face of the earth, 2 seasons ago. They've never really had anything, this year or last year as a backup for, Foster. And, he played what, he only played 4 games this year. He played 12 games last year and missed most of 2013. And you're talking about a guy, you're talking about not having a backup for a running back who played only, 10 games, played only like 3/4 of one season in the past 3 years. And it's just kind of crazy to me that you don't even take a third-round pick, a fourth-round pick, or you can get running backs in the draft. And I think that's kind of another kind of like problem that you see with this Texans team, where they're not able to like look long-term, look at the next step, and lock up guys at that moment, and they don't really have any type of long-term stability going forward. And we're seeing it again at the running back position already.
I think it even goes deeper than that. It also depends on who you take. So when you take an Alfred Blue, when you take a Hilliard, you're taking guys who are plotting guys. There's no explosiveness to them. It's not like you're taking a CJ Anderson or a Darren Oliver type guy. Did I say Darren Oliver? Brandon Oliver guy, who at least has some speed, some shake, and some upside, and has some explosiveness to him. You're taking the most plotting type of running back with Blue and Hilliard you can possibly take. Chris Polk's got a little bit. He's got a little bit of upside. He's better. But when you're pointing at Chris Polk and saying, hey, this guy gives me some upside over Blue and Hilliard in the explosive game, that's a big problem with your roster construction. That's a big problem with taking the type of guys who are going to succeed in the NFL. Alfred Blues do not succeed in the NFL. C.J. Anderson's do. Brandon Oliver's do. C.J. Anderson and Brandon Oliver were both late-round picks. So you're talking about a all-around draft strategy of we're going to take the lowest ceiling guys we can find because they A, are big, and B, they went to LSU. I don't get that.
Yeah, and I mean, and you can get running backs late in the draft, you know. Like Gurley's been great this year, but you've seen what's happened to Melvin Gordon in the first round. You don't want to, you don't need to take quarterback running backs in the first round. You can find those guys third, fourth, and fifth round. They can come in, they can make an impact. You may have to pay one contract for them, but even with them, when they're 27 years old, you can go find another one most of the time. And it's hard to find guys like Foster. You know, he was UDFA, but it's hard to find talent like that. But you can still find guys who are good enough, who have the athleticism, who can come in and get 20 carries for, you know, at least 80 yards. And those guys are all out there, but Houston just has not used any type of draft capital or resource on it besides signing, you know, Foster. And I was thinking about, you know, Foster's contract now, because I was thinking about Cushing and how, you know, he looks slow and he looks done. And the idea, and also like Rick Smith's extensions. And so we've seen him before where he likes to lock guys up the last year of their deal so they don't have a chance to hit free agency and leave. And it's kind of like the worst strategy that baseball teams do where they sign younger guys for 2 years in their deal, they re-sign them for longer term, so they're able to pay them less than they will in the future. But what Rick Smith's been doing is he's been locking these older players up a year early, paying them more, and then having all this, you know, long-term uncertainty occur, then they get injured, and they're stuck paying guys, you know, $9 million so they cannot be paying anymore. And so it's kind of like a dumb Tampa Bay Rays thing. Have you thought about Rick Smith's contract extensions in this slide at all before BFT?
I do, and I go back and forth because it comes down to risk, and the NFL is very risk adverse. NFL coaches are extremely risk averse. So the strategy is, of course, that you tie up the guy long term and hope nothing happens to him. In football, that's not very realistic. I do think it's okay to take chances on positions where offensive linemen, defensive linemen, when there's not going to be as much
Quarterback.
fluctuation, and there's I mean, to a certain extent, quarterback, because you're chances of getting hurt and losing explosiveness are more minimized. Locking up Cushing was questionable because Cushing already had an injury history. He already had a steroid history. I mean, he already had things in his backstory saying, hey, this might not be the best guy to sign to a long-term contract, and we did. Arian Foster, look, I love Arian Foster. If there's one guy I'm going to give that contract to when we gave Foster that contract, it's him. You're talking about that he just has to be that special of a player, which he was in his prime. But you also he had an injury issues, and you're taking a gamble that these guys are going to stay healthy. I think once you start seeing the Cushings and the Fosters who have the deeper injury histories, who have lost considerable time, then I don't know if signing long term is the best idea. However, what do you do if you don't sign an Arian Foster? What do you do if you don't sign a Brian Cushing and you let these guys walk? Well, that's taking a risk too that these guys stay healthy. So I go back and forth. I really do. I don't know what the best strategy is. I think taking the body of work and including the injury history is important. I do think injuries are a skill, which I know some people disagree with, but I think that is the most important skill that an athlete can have is to have a clean injury history. So, you know, these are difficult things to sort through and figure out. I don't know what the long-term answer is, but when you look at the teams who are the most successful, Green Bay, New England, those sorts of teams, they do lock up guys. They do lock up their Chandler Joneses and their Aaron Rodgers and their Clay Matthews types players at that point with those contracts, but those guys also have had cleaner injury histories in their careers.
Yeah, I guess I didn't articulate as well as I wanted to, but I guess my idea, if you know, I'm a GM, I want to re-sign a guy at the age of 24, 25 to a 5 year, 4 year contract that takes him to 29, 30, and re-sign him, you know, 2 years early or whatever and run the risk. And then you can also pay him a little bit less too, and he has, you know, a year or two left on his contract. So then you're getting this guy until 24, 29, Revin Foster, who I think is under contract until he's 32. I think Cushing's about the same way he's in their contract until he's 32, 33. Unless you're talking about a guy, J.J. Watt, he's just a transcendent, you know, special overall talent. And, you know, you don't really see it that much in football. You see it a lot in baseball for the teams who can't, you know, re-sign their stars sooner, and they have these young players are rookie contracts and paid $700,000 a year. And so between that, you know, $6 million is so huge that they usually sign it. And so I would like to see, you know, NFL teams kind of take this approach more often where, you know, you're getting these guys at their peak instead of paying for after their peak and then having the dead money and then having nobody come in to fill in for them afterwards. Does that make more sense?
It does. And I think the we keep talking about age 30. And I think really that age 30 is a very important age in the NFL. And unless you're an offensive lineman, I would not touch you at the age of 30. Because mm-hmm. that you're going to lose your physical abilities, to set your explosiveness. All those things happen. There are so many miles on these bodies by the time they turn 30 years old. I wouldn't touch any body but an offensive lineman past the age of 30. And so when you talk about signing Brian Cushing I think 32 or 33, you're right on that. To me, that's silly. I don't know if you can sign him otherwise because he can turn that contract down, but my goodness, you're really going to lock a guy up who relies on his athleticism with an injury history, and you think he's going to be productive at age 30, 31, 32? His chances are probably not. So those to me are poor risks to take to me. But then again, you have to balance. Hey, Cushing can go out and get 6 years, $96 million somewhere else. So there's a lot of balancing that goes on with these signings, and I wish I had the answer. I know what I do in Madden. I don't sign anybody past age 30. They're gone. I trade them. All right, that's it. Their contract goes through 30. What's their age? They go through 30. That's it. Bring on the next guy. Because
I actually like resigning guys in Madden because they don't get the well. Thing about Madden is they don't really drop all that much, so you can resign them. I love free agency in Madden too. But yeah, I guess the game I always play is MLB Baseball 2005. And I've been re-signing guys 3 years before their contract's gone up since I was, you know, 15 years old. And so I was so excited whenever I saw teams like the Rays do this. And I really want to see NFL teams do it because it just seems like the best way to do it. You pay guys more money before than they're usually able to get, and you get them at the peak of their lifespan rather than paying them whenever more risk has occurred over time and there's more chance of injuries. And so you're paying these guys at a lot of money at 29 rather than 33. And that's a huge difference. And so I'd like to see that kind of carry on to the NFL. But
yeah, and I think we see a perfect example. I was just going to say, I think we see a perfect example of that in Vince Wilfork. Wilfork was an effective football player last year. This year he's not. Mm-hmm. You just don't know when they're done. You don't know. And it's what Branch Rickey used to say, you want to trade a guy a year too early rather than a year too late. And that's something mm-hmm. I've always kind of stuck by when I think about my talent evaluations is, you're going to trade a guy, not re-sign a guy, do it a year too early, not a year too late. Because what's going to happen is that player's performance is going to drop off a cliff, and it's going to take you a while to understand it's now a sunk cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I'm going to write that down, remember that for next time I write any type of off-season stuff. But the real breaking news today was in the form of Ryan Mallett, and he's no more. And so the backstory on this was that Ryan Mallett said he got stuck in traffic, missed a team flight. He had to take a charter plane to Miami. But the real, you know, juicy, you know, as the world turns drama came in the fact that Bill O'Brien wanted to cut Ryan Mallett right on the spot. You know, he had enough of him. I don't know. He was trying to install his culture, send a message, whatever. And Rick Smith told, you know, Bill O'Brien, hey, man, it's probably not a good idea to go into a football game with only one quarterback, so we should probably keep Ryan Mallett at least for Sunday. And he overruled Bill O'Brien in the situation. Then Tuesday comes, and Ryan Mallett gets cut, and he's no more. So, BFT, who is Ryan in the situation? Are you more on the side of Rick Smith or Bill O'Brien?
Oh, God. I mean, that's like asking me, oh, who is more right in this decision? Is it Ho Chi Minh or is it, I don't know. So,
is it peanut butter or chocolate?
It's like, you know, you're going to ask me what dumbass in history I want to be. On this one, I admit that I understood the logic behind both of them. And I'm not trying to weasel out. I think if it would have been me, I would have probably been on Rick Smith's side and said, let's sign somebody first. I think that I don't know if they had to do something with Mallett. I see Mallett being cut as like this very scapegoat thing. But at the same time, you know, if what's true is they actually missed the team meeting first and then was late to the airport, well, then that's just a double hammer on him with everything else. So, I think you had to make a move with him, but yeah, the whole situation, it goes back to me. It goes back to training camp when you've got a choice to make. You're probably telling Ryan Mallett, look, we signed Brian Hoyer. It's your job to lose. Come back and sign with us. And I would not doubt it if that was the conversation that happened, because I think Mallett could have gone somewhere else and gotten more money. And so when he comes back and is pissed off that he does not win the job to Brian fucking Hoyer, I'd be pissed too. I gotta admit, I'd be pissed too. I wouldn't be a pouty little whiny asshole on the sideline, but I'd be pretty pissed too. And then you think about how he was pulled out of the Colts game, which is utter rubbish, utter rubbish. Not getting the job, first of all, the way he was pulled out of the Colts game. Ryan Mallett might be the most dicked around player I've seen in a very long time. So there's a lot not to like there, and
Except for
I guess
RG3,
if
of
you,
course.
So this whole thing's just it's an uncoordinated lack of strategy, plan that really, to me, just if you want to point at one situation and say this is your 2015 Houston Texans, just the way we handled the quarterback situation.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't think of it like that too, as far as, I mean, it's a good metaphor. It just kind of showed just like how disorganized everything is from the top, to the bottom, and just all the different of just like levels of things, all the different things that occur over time to get to this point. You see Mal miss that practice. You see Mal lose his job to Hoyer, and I guess he lost his job to Hoyer before that, but he misses the practice. Hoyer's terrible. He starts. He plays well in garbage time. They beat the Bucks. Then he plays awful against Atlanta. Hoyer comes in garbage time. He plays well. Then he gets injured at Indy, and then he's sulk on the bench the rest of the year. And they miss these two meetings, and he's done. And then you have this kind of like disagreement up top. And so the whole thing's kind of a mess. It is kind of like the Natty Light compared to the natural that is the RG3 Redskins thing. But I think the situation went about as well as it can. I think Rick Smith was right to step in and say, no, O'Brien, we need to have at least two quarterbacks this game. Whatever we want to do on Monday or Tuesday, that's different. But having him step in aside and tell Bill O'Brien, no, we're not going to come, was the right decision. And I think things played out about as well as they can. But it's whenever it gets out to the media, whenever it gets spun around and it turns into this whole mommy and daddy fighting thing, then if you're a player in this organization, how do you feel about that? How do free agents go forward? How is your perception of the Texans when you get drafted and coming in? And it all, kind of plays a part in all whenever you're trying to, build a team now so they're gonna have to go ahead and do moving forward.
Yeah, and those are great. Those are great, great points. I didn't even think about is what the Houston Texans are saying to potential free agents. First, you've got Bill O'Brien yelling at everybody during practice, and I know coaches yell. I know it, but these are professionals. They don't like to be yelled at. They don't. It's not that is a if you want to do it in college, maybe that works. Well, this is a different age. This isn't the '60s where yelling at players is going to be the way to motivate them. So you've got Bill O'Brien basically being an asshole on TV for 5 weeks. And then you've got the clusterfuck situation with the quarterback. And now, like you said, mommy and daddy fighting over when we do this. That looks terrible. This organization absolutely looks like a dumpster fire to everybody on the outside. We're going to struggle because of that.
I think what kind of sums up, you talk about this whole thing, sums up the dumpster fire. I think for me, it's whenever the Texans lost the, no, they beat the Jaguars, and everybody wants to fire Bradley as the head coach because they lost the Houston Texans. And I think once you reach that level, whenever you're beating teams and they want their head coach fired after the result, you've reached, pretty much just the cellar of the league. And now I want to talk about Bill O'Brien. You mentioned your incompletions post that you're done with him as a coach after the Foster injury. And I was wondering if you want to go ahead and elaborate on that, on your entry that you made for the post.
Yeah, I don't know. You never know what bullshit to believe when it comes to coach speak and owner speak and that sort of thing. So I'm going to go kind of in reverse chronological order. You got Bob McNair saying after the game how great the team played in the second half. if that's really how you feel about a team, if they're doing well in garbage time, then right there you're losing all credibility, because we're down 41-0 in was it the first quarter or partway through the second quarter? I can't even remember now. We're down 41-0. We're out of the game. And you're excited about the second half when they've got backups in about how well the team has played. You've got, like you said, to kick off the post or the kick off the show. We've got no chance to win. Like, realistically speaking, we have no chance. And you can talk about honor, glory, and whatever about the rest of the game, but it ain't gonna happen. And at some point, you have to recognize that. And so you have to say to yourself, I can't harm my team. Like the for doctors, first do no harm. Well, when you leave your starters out on a wet field, you're doing harm. You're making an extremely poor decision. And that's why I'm so riled up about Foster's injury, is because he should not have been out there. Talking about a guy who's only been back for 2 weeks, should not have been out there. J.J. Watt, Jadeveon Clowney, Brian Cushing. Why are these guys getting snaps in trash time, in late fourth quarter trash time? And they were still on the field. I don't want to hear any of the bullshit about that we pulled some of our safeties and cornerbacks out and had Roll and those guys playing. Yes, they were playing, but Watt and Clowney and Cushing were still in the game. And if I remember correctly, the guy who led our team in defensive snaps was Brian Cushing. So that to me just absolutely shows a lack of what you're doing out there on the field and or as a coach on the sideline. Why are those guys even out there? That is utterly ridiculous. It is irresponsible. It is pathetic. And I just, that's it. It broke me. I was done. So Cushing had 63 snaps. Watt had 59 snaps. Clowney 51. And those are the top three on the team. So don't give me any bullshit about, hey, that we pulled some of our safeties and cornerbacks out. We only did it for the defense. No, we didn't. Those guys are still playing at the end of the game on the wet turf in trash time. I think I'm pretty much done with that rant.
It was very pretty. And, I think it's just kind of, ridiculous. I think MVC and his, entry and incompletion style, I love this thing, by the way. I really am a sigh every time I get you and MVC's entry, because they're always a lot of fun to read. But I think he, so the best, I think the only argument behind it is that he's trying to make it look like they did not get beat as bad as they did, when it's completely obvious. I mean, they shouldn't have even stepped on the field. I mean, you're down 41-0 to a team that, was what, was 1-3 before they beat the Titans, and they beat the Redskins by 3 points. And I mean, it's just insane. And I think the best thing I can think of with Bill O'Brien is this idea that him being a college coach, and the difference between the pros in college and any level, I think, is the fact that in college, your players are only there for, 4 years at most, and they go somewhere else. The head coach is the only stability. His coaching staff is the only stability there. They're the cornerstone of that program. They're the only guy who's there year to year to year. Everybody else leaves and they go on and do other things in their life, but the coach is there. And the pros is completely different. When you have these players there, they're there for 10 years, 15 years, 12 years, whatever the number you want to throw out there. But they're the ones who run the organization. They're the ones who make the plays. They're the ones who are going to be there year after year after year. And the coach isn't as important as all the coach's job to do is to put players in the best position to succeed. He's not the star at all that they are in college. And I think with O'Brien, what you're seeing is a guy who, I think he thinks too much of himself. He feels like he has too much of a role and everything that goes on. We understand that he's just there to put these guys in the spot to succeed. And I think that's just the biggest failure I've seen on the defense side of the ball as well, where you're just having a bunch of guys, a bunch of spots where they're not able to make plays and do what they do best. And I think it kind of just stems from there. And, I've been upset with O'Brien before with how he kicks field goals and, blowouts, how he manages the clock, how he uses his challenges, how he does on fourth down. And then I think it's kind of changed now to just insane decisions like playing your starters this late to make the blowout look a whole lot less. And now even to just not even, being confident really anymore with how this team has performed this year.
If you look back on 2013, it's been mentioned ad nauseum, But if you look back on 2013, that was at least a competitive squad. This is the third game where you've looked at this team going, this is not a professional NFL team. You know, we're down 40 again. We're down 30 again. This is not how a team should come out prepared. So this goes back to, you know, the Bill O'Brien. Is he getting our team prepared? Is he, and he put it perfectly, the term I like to use, is he putting his players in a position to succeed? And the answer is not only no, but it's, my goodness gracious, fuck no. There's no way. If you're down 41-0, if you're getting blown out by the Falcons, you're getting gashed right and left by the run game, pass game, your offense is shit. No, you're not preparing your team to win. Think you're going to come out and run power sweeps, 3 yards in a cloud of dust, and win with your defense in 2015 football, then you have not been paying attention to football in the last 15 years. You just haven't. And so when you put all these things together, it's just like either he's completely the most arrogant, conceited person in the world, or he doesn't have a clue. Either way, I don't want that leading my team.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked a lot about O'Brien, and I mean, he's not the only coach who's had a bad year. You know, both, I don't know if his name, if it's Gatsby or Gatsby or whatever, the offensive coordinator, the offense is, I think, ranked 27th in DVOI. The defense is 26th, with special teams at 32nd again, and they're, you know, 31st. They're just ahead of the 49ers in the season. But I don't know. So the question I'm getting to is that who do you think is going to be fired first? Rick Smith, Bill O'Brien, Gatsby or Gatsby, I can't remember his name exactly, or how to say it, or Romeo Crennel. So which of these coaches or which one of these, you know, I guess corporate level positions do you see getting switched soonest?
I think Tim nails it. Rick Smith is not going to be fired. He's going to be promoted. He's going to be promoted into head coffee fetcher or something and made a director or whatever crap they're going to do with him. He'll be promoted. I think the first one to be fired will be Crennel. That defense, because there were expectations for the defense, right? They were supposed to be a good year. Yeah. They were supposed to be able to keep the Texans in games. And we're getting gashed like we are, not how you keep Texans and teams in games. And PFF had us down for 16 missed tackles on Sunday. I don't know about you, but I think on Landry's head alone, there were 16 missed tackles. So it's a very, very poor fundamentals, poor schematic defense. So I think he's going to be the first to get the axe.
And somebody wrote a really good article about that defense, too, last week.
Somebody did.
Yes, somebody did.
Very good. Excellent post.
I agree, too. I think Crennel's the first one to go. And, I mean, they went from 6th, you know, to 27th in DVOA, and I read all about it, but I think to me what stands out the most is the fact that Watt and Clowney are not being used together. I mean, that's the perfect symbiotic relationship. You know, that's the little fish eating the bacteria off the shark as it swims around the ocean. I mean, it's just beautiful and it's perfect to, you know, set up for those two guys to work together and succeed. And that's where your defense starts. You know, that's where you're building your team, are those two guys right there. And he just hasn't done it. And so I think by that fact alone, with addition to the members, like he has, you know, he should go. And I don't know who you bring in after, maybe Vrabel, maybe another one of defensive coaches, but I agree with you too. I think Crennel will be the first one to go.
Yeah, and speaking of Watt, he doesn't, you remember back in the old days when he used to move around the line? He'd jump around, he'd be nose tackle, defensive tackle, and, you know, depending 4-3-3-4, and or he'd be left end, right end. He pretty much exclusively plays left end these days. You're wasting talent out there. You're not getting him in the best matchup. Yes, you're at least getting him against the right tackle instead of the left tackle. Thank you. But you're still where he is going to be most dangerous is a swim move on the interior line against centers and guards. That's where he blows shit up. Mm-hmm. And you're lining him, and it's almost like the 9-wide technique sometimes, and you're forcing him to cover more ground where his swim move's not going to be as effective.
I think that's perfect, too. I'm thinking about that. And 3-4, you know, he's playing a 4-eye or a 4. He's playing over the tackle, not over the guard. And, you know, we're talking about 2 feet here, but that 2 feet can be the difference between, you know, a double team or not a double team. It's the difference between being able to get to the running back or not in the backfield. And then, the 9-technique pass rush stuff is so stupid. Like, I mean, What makes him so great as a pass rusher is he's just as strong as these guards he goes against, but he's so much faster that he's able to get past him without dealing with the center at all in the double team because of his quickness. And so you're completely negating his ability by scheme alone. And I didn't even think about this at all until you brought it up. But yeah, it's a great point. And it's just insane that they're not, because they used him pretty well last year, but it's insane to have a guy like Watt and not be able to just put him in the right spot to succeed, because it's easy. He's so goddamn good that it's really impossible not to do it.
Yep.
Well, I think, we've been talking for about 40 minutes now, and I really enjoy all the discussion. I think there's things that need to be talked about. I don't know if it even worked that way because we wanted to, wanted to talk about these things, or we just really did not want to talk about this Dolphins game. But
A
I
little of each.
think, yeah. Yeah, so I just
Because
think it's something fun.
we're talking about the, if we're going to talk about the Dolphins game, it's such a micro problem compared to the macro issues this team has right now. It's this, you and I have really, we've been pummeled for it all year in the comments that they're so negative, but I think we've done a good job, and I'm patting myself on the back, and please forgive my arrogance. We've really been talking about these macro problems all year, and once we get into the game, well, that's great. We're supposed to talk about the games, but look, these are big deal items that have been on the table since training camp and that have not been solved. So, forgive us if we sometimes feel like we're being a little meta on you.
Yeah, and we had that one discussion a few weeks ago, and the whole idea is that we try to be realistic. Do you want to listen to, somebody riots who aren't going to give their opinion, who are going to pander to their audience? You listen to people talk who aren't going to, say what they feel or think, so you can, feel better and not get upset whenever they try to tell you exactly what they feel. No, that's why, you listen. That's what you want to read. You want to hear people's opinions on things, hopefully learn more and be entertained by it. And that's all we try to do. But we'll talk about this Dolphins game, briefly, and there are some things I want to touch on. And the first is I have some really, really fun stats from this game. The boy, these are hilarious. So it took until 7:51 in the fourth quarter with a score of 41-20 for Ryan Tannehill to throw an incompletion. Now, in this game, I don't know if you saw it on the broadcast, but I think it was the second touchdown pass to Landry, and Tannehill did the Michael Jordan shrug after Landry went from one sideline to the other and broke five tackles. He just kind of shrugged his shoulders, just like Michael Jordan in the finals against the Blazers, and I could not believe it. Of all the players that ever do the, greatest celebration ever is Ryan Tannehill. Some other ones I have is that the Dolphins had five touchdowns before the Texans had 5 yards. The Dolphins scored 35 points before the Texans had a first down. And the Dolphins had 300 yards before the Texans had 1 yard. Now, BFD, do you have any fun stats like this from Sunday's game?
No, you've covered the big ones, and let's be honest here. As somebody in the comments today, I didn't respond. Asked the question: Is this the worst? Was that the worst half of football you've ever seen? And I think the answer is definitively yes. Not only were we were pants, our underwear was run up the flagpole, and every girl in school was pointing at our shriveled penises and giggling hysterically. That's what happened. It was surreal. I haven't even seen a high school game that was that awful. It must have been, for the people who are around and back then, it must have been like watching the Great Cumberland game that was 222 to nothing. That's what that first quarter felt like.
Well, we'll pile on to the pantsing and people laughing at our shriveled little wieners. But I'm going to go through the five touchdowns in the first half, or the six touchdowns, and have us rank them from our favorite to, or I guess not our most enjoyable to, I guess the most lukewarm enjoyable. So the first touchdown was the 53-yard pass to Rishard Matthews. And this is a slant route where he ran past Kevin Joseph, and Raheem Moore took the worst angle I've ever seen. The second one was the 50-yard touchdown, Jarvis Landry. And this is one where he ran sideline to sideline, broke five tackles. The third one was a 10-yard touchdown, Jarvis Landry again. This came on third and four in the red zone, a slant route. Then there's a 54-yard fake end-around screen to Lamar Miller. After that was a 23-yard Rashad Jones pick six after Fedor with his hilarious drop. And then Lamar Miller ramped the middle for 85 yards. So, BFT, I'll give you my first one. If you disagree at all, if you want to put one ahead of the other, just let me know. So I think my favorite one of the bunch was the Jones pick six. And I think it was because Fedor was running such a simple route into the flat. It hits him in the chest. He loses in the air, rolls around, and the ball pops back up, and Jones picks it off and takes it to the house. I love it because it's so perfectly encapsulated the Texans' inability to throw the ball to the tight ends. And also, by that point in the game, that was the last thing I was waiting for. I was kind of waiting for Brian Hoyer pick six so I could change the channel. Was that your favorite one as well from Sunday?
Definitely. I think, and I could be wrong, I know it was four times, but I think it might have been five times that our tight ends were targeted, and they were dropped. Every target was a drop for our tight ends on Sunday. That was amazeballs. To have Garrett Graham and CJF be that woefully incompetent that they dropped every target thrown their way. One of them for pick six. Yep, I agree.
Yeah, I was looking at Gameplay Finder yesterday. I saw that I think Graham has a 30% catch rate since last year in Bill O'Brien's offense. And they're paying him, you know, $4 million a year to do that. Number two for me was the Miller 85-yard touchdown run. And again, I think this is another just like beautiful example. I think a lot of problems in this defense, a lot of these players just kind of microcosms of the team as a whole. And this was just a perfect example of Will Fuller getting obliterated by an ace block, which is blocked between the guard and center. And then Miller runs right off that block, 85 yards right through the safeties for a touchdown. Would you put that number two as well?
No, my number two would be Landry's 50-yard touchdown. That was on an embarrassment scale when you're looking at your defense and you're in the room, meeting room the next Monday, and you're looking at that. If I'm the defensive coach, I'm just going to put that on auto loop and walk away. That was absolutely embarrassing, pitiful, terrible football. So that one's my number two.
Yeah, I had that as three, and then I had the Miller one run as two, mostly because I think Vince Wilford's terrible, and I really don't like him. Where would you put Miller's run at then, from 1-6?
Number three.
Okay, and then four for me would be the 53-yard touchdown on Rashard Matthews. And
Rashard,
you know,
Matthews,
I think,
yeah.
I think part of it was he ran a slant, and he faked outside, and you know he's 2 yards from the sideline. And Johnson goes all the way over there. I mean, he completely ran the nearly out of bounds on this play. And he's not going over there, man. You're that close to the sideline. You seem like one of those rookie mistakes. But what makes the play hilarious, though, is Raheem Moore on this play. He comes at a terrible angle. He just meekly dives at his legs, probably 4 yards away. And he just looks so slow and so out of place. And that's his only job back there. He's a single high safety in all these plays. And that's your center fielder, and that's the best he can do. When that's his only job in this defense is to make sure that doesn't happen. I think it was hysterical. It was one of the funniest things. All these players are just some of the funniest things I've ever seen. Would you put that as four as well?
Yeah, definitely, because that was that right there we've talked about from day one. Our safety play was going to suck, and that was a perfect example of it. That was Raheem Moore not knowing what – wow. I mean, it's not like Rashard Matthews is that – fantastic. It's not like he's that fast. It's that Raheem Moore just did not know what he was doing out on the field. It's pathetic. Sorry.
And five, I have the screen to Miller. And that was just good play design. You know, that was just a really nicely executed play. They had, you know, like seven blockers down the field. It was just pretty. And then six, I have the 10-yard touchdown Landry. And so I'm guessing
yep.
We probably just agreed on two and three.
That's right.
Well, it's about that time. The only question I was able to get to, we'll ask next week. And I believe we got to everybody's questions, too, as well. I know we talked about what Ron asked, if we thought, you know, Smith would be fired the season's end. And, you know, you said that you agree with Tim where he'll probably be promoted higher up. And I have no disagreements in that, whatever. So we'll talk about the other team that lost, the angry Miami Dolphins. And this is a team that the Texans show no other similarities with whatsoever, the Tennessee Titans. BFT, have you watched the Titans play this year? And you know, if so, what are your general thoughts on them?
I actually think that they're funny enough, in a lot of ways, like the baby-eating sister fuckers of Mesopotamia, the Texans are.
Yeah, I was trying to be sarcastic.
The fact
on
is,
that.
Oh, okay. Because it what the defense is basically the defense is basically their defense is basically Jarrell Casey and a bunch of assholes, and our defense is basically J.J. Watt and a bunch of assholes. Sure, you got not much of an asshole in Jadeveon Clowney, and you got not much of an asshole in Brian Arakpo, but the Titans secondary is might be the worst in the NFL. Michael Griffin, I don't see. I haven't understood for 5 years how Michael Griffin still has a job in the NFL. So
and
he's still back.
He's
still
one of the worst. And it's on the same team he got drafted by too.
Right, it's incredible. It's amazing
it's
to me.
That, when I mean, that happens.
He's like a 10-year veteran at this point. He still has a job.
And the same team that drafted him. I always can't. You know, I always really enjoy that when these really crappy players are drafted in the first round and they just stay there mostly because they were drafted by them in the first round.
Right, right, right. And they have to have pictures of the wife's coach or something, or the coach's wife. Never mind. Blew that joke.
Went right over my head like a Ryan Mountbatten.
It's either going to be 10 yards in front of you or 10 yards over your head. yeah, and you know, the difference is, and I haven't checked today. I think Mariota is still supposed to be out for this game. So we'll get to see the beauty that is Zach Mettenberger. But, you know, at least the BESFs have hope at quarterback. Marcus Mariota has played far better than I expected he would. Far, far better. I thought Ken Whisenhunt would absolutely destroy him, force him to try to be a pro quarterback and to make constantly pro throws, and he hasn't forced him to do that. Mariota has come back to earth after the first. He started off pretty well. He's come back, but at least there's something there. At least there's talent there, and that's we've got Brian Hoyer. So yeah, even Zach Mettenberger. Yeah, and even Zach Mettenberger gets you excited. I mean, at least he's, you know, he's like Ryan, a little bit brighter Ryan Mallett with better accuracy. Man, shit, if we get excited about Ryan Mallett, then yeah, much better. So they're a lot like us. Their offensive line is absolute ass. They have nothing that resembles a running back on the roster. They have athletic talent at wide receiver, guys like Kendall Wright and DGB. So they're another very, very poor NFL team. There's just no other way to put it.
Yeah, I just went to – I've actually watched some Tennessee Times offensive, you know, play whenever – or game film because I work on the Sherman Lake article. And what I like about the Titans is it's kind of funny where they did the San Francisco 49ers, Dallas Cowboys team-building route, where they're going to invest all their resources in their offensive line. And they tried, and they failed spectacularly. They had Mike Munchak as their head coach. They drafted Taylor Lewan with the 8th pick. They drafted Chance Warmack with the 6th pick, I believe. They gave LaVitre and O'Hara a ton of money. They had really bad center, and they went and got another guy who was actually pretty good. And so now you only have Lewan and Warmack left on the roster from this team. The center guy hurt a few weeks ago, and they have a 6th-round pick starting there now. But then you have a bad free agent left guard, so I can't remember his name, and then you have a rookie playing right tackle next to Warmack. And they suck. Their offensive line is terrible. And I think one of the things, they don't know what they're trying to do in the run game. They're kind of like how Houston is at times. So they run power and they run outside zone. And you just kind of pick one of those. If we're going to run man schemes, we're going to run man schemes. And we're going to get really good at it. We're going to get good at this one thing, and you're not going to stop it. And they don't do that at all. They're just kind of all over the place with their offense. And it's not very much fun to watch. I think Luan's a terrible run blocker. He plays too high. He has good feet, but he's just too high and he takes plays off. Warmack, I think he's slow-footed. And he's a good puller, but he can't play the zone game at all. And, you know, they have problems there. They spend all their resources and all that time. They're already having to rebuild and pay dead money to these guys. And so now they kind of change their strategy to, you know, rookie quarterback plus quarterback guru equals, you know, wins. And those wins haven't happened yet. But, that's pretty much my Titans analysis. I think the one kind of fun thing, you know, you're talking about their defense, and they're actually 9th in DVOA in defense. And it's because they have the 6th best pass pass defense. A lot of this is because of their pass rush, and they have the 30th ranked run defense, which is just such an insane split.
Yeah, and it really sticks out because honestly, when you look at their pass defense, their safeties and cornerbacks are terrible. And so I don't get it, and I don't get how when you got Jarrell Casey who makes plays, Brian Arakpo who makes plays, Wesley Woodyard who isn't bad, I guess. But yeah, so I mean, it's crazy, and I wonder if that, you know, I know that DVOA is supposed to take in consideration the talent that you're playing against, but that still is, seems like it's completely flipped the wrong way. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they have the sixth best adjusted sack rate. So they have 15 sacks this year, but they're behind, you know, so much that teams are running the ball. But their adjusted sack rate is 8.2%. And, you know, this would be a great game for Arian Foster. But, you know, sadly, he's no more. So I guess I'm going to ask
you. Too soon!
In my brain, I still see him laying there on that field, lifeless. And if I was on the sideline and just walked over, I would wrap my arms around him and tell him it's going to be okay. But so, you know, you touched on Mariota, and what have you seen from him so far this year? And have you seen him play? And also, the second part of this question is that him and Winston be compared to each other for the rest of their careers. And so we watched Winston a few weeks back. Which one of these quarterbacks do you like as well, in addition to your Mariota, Ron Jaworski analysis?
It's really a hard call because they are fairly different quarterbacks. They really are. Marcus Mariota is much more athletic than Winston. And what's funny about Winston is he does not look – He looks as unathletic as Matt Schaub to me out there. I mean, he looks very lumbering, doesn't really – I don't know if he's out of shape, but he looks slow. He moves well in the pocket, so he's got that going for him. But I expected Helm to have much better wheels coming out of college. And to me, he just looks – the word I keep groping for is uncoordinated. And it's really a disconnect from what I thought he was going to bring to the table. I think they're very similar. I mean, really, Winston's thrown a lot more interceptions, and by a lot more, I mean, it's like two, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it's two more interceptions. They both throw 9 touchdowns. I think, if given the chance, I would have taken Winston first overall. Now, I think I would take Mariota. I think it's just that athleticism and the difference between the two. I would have also put Mariota in a system that he could succeed in. And when you also consider the fact that Winston's got just such much better skill set or skill player tools around him. Doug Martin looks much better this year, much less Mike Evans and Vincent Jackson and Austin Seferian Jenkins. I think he's got better tools because when you turn around, you look at what the Titans are giving him to work with, like Bishop Sankey and Kendall Wright. I mean, these aren't good players. So I would probably take Mariota first, but yeah, they're always going to be compared, but it's very much like comparing apples to Nazi oranges.
Yeah. And I think the thing with the comparison between the two is kind of like how they're bringing them about. With Mariota, I'm seeing a lot of what they did with Derek Carr last year in Oakland, where Mariota's running a lot of that. Well, some of the stuff he ran in college where he runs the zone read, that play action fake, and then just drops it to the tight end on the post route right in the middle of the field. He's running a lot of that. He's also running a lot of, you know, drag routes, curl routes, comeback routes, and lots of short, and they're not really giving him like a chance to like run a full offense. You know, he's being limited in a lot of ways. And so I know they're trying to build up his confidence, trying to get him up to speed, because I think the biggest difference between any level of football, from middle school to freshman to JV to varsity to college to the pros, is just the speed of the game just increases so much. And so I think that's what all they're trying to do, is they're trying to get him used to the speed of the game, get him used to making reads, getting used to making, you know, decisions quicker. But at the same time, you know, you're limiting him, you know, so much in what he can do whenever you're running an offense like this. With Winston, though, it's the complete opposite. I mean, that Texans game, he's throwing a 30-yard pass, you know, 2 yards from his own end zone. I mean, they're letting him take shots deep, and they want him to, and they're throwing the whole thing at him. And so I think that's where the comparisons would be interesting to me, where it's just a fascinating case study on quarterback development, where you have these two guys who are being brought along in two completely different offenses and being asked to do two completely different things. Now, a lot of that's due to their skill set as far as the offense goes, but how much is expanded upon is, you know, what's really interesting to me when it comes to these two guys. But as far as who's having the better year, I think Winston is just because of what he's asked to do. He's asked to do a whole lot more than Mariota is. And they're both playing behind the offensive lines too, but I think Winston's having, you know, a better year. And I don't have any opinion on who I would take one over the other just yet. But I think Winston's had a better season thus far.
And if you think about where they're coming from their college skills and from their college experience, Winston was never afraid to push the ball downfield. Never afraid. That's what he did. And then Mariota was, you know, you had to limit Mariota because number one, he's playing in Chip Kelly's offense, which is not asking, which is asking your quarterback to be out of the pocket and on the move and making throws, which does not work as well in the pros, as we repeatedly see. So I think that both teams are doing a good job letting those players be themselves and what they came from college last year. It's if Mariota, I think, is going to be the big question, is if he can take that extra step and be able to make those downfield throws. But he wasn't asked to do that very often in Oregon.
Well,
But
and you
man,
know
I
Mariota
just got
kicked
to
before.
yeah.
I was surprised. And also, Winston was a 4.97 40.
He looks like he runs a 6.97 40.
Slower than I
I mean,
was hoping.
The dude looks slow, and it's shocking to see with his body type. He should not be that slow. But he see, when we played him, he reminded me of Schaub when he scrambled.
That'd be a fun gift. I wish I could make gifts because you could superimpose the two. But anyways, real quickly, do you have any matchups you're looking forward to this week? Whenever you watch the game on Sunday, what are you going to be staring at the television looking at?
It's going to be interesting to see if Chris Clark can come back from the really crappy, horrible game he had again. Clark was our
Cameron Wake's
savior,
really good.
and he looked really good. And then Sunday happened, and he was eaten alive the entire game. We could have put a turnstile there and at least made Cameron Wake jump over the turnstile, and it would have been more effective than Chris Clark. It was ugly. I mean, that's absolutely one of the worst games I've seen by an offensive lineman for the Texans in a long time. So does he bounce back? It's going to be a question. Are the Titans going to see that? And is Clark going to see a lot of Jarrell Casey and a lot of Brian Arakpo? And so that'll be interesting because Cameron Wake is a very, very good pass rusher, granted, and that was something I was really worried about going into that matchup. But against the Dolphins, but you know, Arakpo and Casey are going could potentially eat him alive as well. And then, hey, we're going to have to address, you know, the offensive line heavily. I mean, once again, it's just another hole, and I still don't understand the strategy of kicking Derek Newton inside when you know, why are you weakening a position, two positions at the expense of one? I don't get it. I never have. I don't know what that team is doing sometimes.
Yeah, I think during the bye week, I'll have a good Texans offensive line article whenever I have some more time. Yeah, I think it's important. It's kind of, it feels like 2013 all over again, though. We're watching two crappy teams play against each other. And these games are a lot of fun, too, because as a fan of both these teams, you're the only people in America watching, you know, these two idiots hump the doorknob. And it really is a blast to just watch two terrible football teams, the only you're invested in. And you and your fans and team are in your own little just stupid bubble of a world, and it's always a lot of fun. Besides the fun I have watching this game on Sunday, I like watching J.J. Watt as the tight end. Hopefully, you know, like you know, Romeo Crennel's listening to us again. Like he moved Kareem Jackson to safety, he moves J.J. Watt to play the three technique, play against the guard, let him go to town against Chance Warmack. He's really good at that. And so Watt loves playing the tight ends. I'm just gonna watch J.J. Watt a lot. And then see if anybody can run the ball off the middle from there. But those are the two things I'm looking forward to.
Nice.
Well, now comes our prediction. And, you know, sadly, I'm so, I mean, I will always hate Bill O'Brien forever. He can bring a Super Bowl to Houston. I'm always going to hate him for allowing his team to lose to Miami Dolphins. I mean, it's just the most just like beautiful undefeated streak ever. They have a franchise as bad as this one's been since 2002. They'll go 7-0 against any team, let alone, a fairly competent franchise. But anyways, I picked them to lose, and this season I'm 5-2 and you're 6-1 pick when picking Texans games. Now before I give my pick, we need to at least have something up for stake at the end of the year for this contest we have going on. And so I was thinking that whoever loses buys the other person something Texans related. And I'll leave it as vague and as open as that. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Sounds great.
Sound good to you? All right. Well, good.
Yeah.
So anyways, like I said, you're one game up, but 6-1. I'm 5-2. So who do you have in this one?
In this one, I don't know. I don't even want to make a pick. I mean, I really don't, because both these teams suck so bad. The Texans clearly aren't that bad of a football team, but picking the Texans to win right now is just like it's like going and playing roulette and putting all your money on yellow. So, I think I'm going to go with the Texans in this game, just because the Titans are that bad, and I think they're going to put up a lot of points because it's a trashy team. So I'm going to go with 31 to 24, your Houston Texans.
Yeah. Oh, and I just want, before I get my other reiterate, actually, I'm 4-3, and you're 5-2, because we both picked Jacksonville, and we picked them to beat Indy as well. I'm actually
Oh,
going to
that's right.
go.
You're right.
Yeah, I want to reiterate to the fans who are really paying attention to, our prediction this year. Now, as we get paid a ton of money to be right, there's a lot at stake. But I'm going to pick Tennessee, actually, especially after looking at the DVOA ratings, where Brian, they don't, with Arian Foster's out, they can't run the football. Brian Hoyer's running into good pass defense, and it's what makes pass defense good is its ability to rush the passer. And with all the changing and lack of continuity on the offensive line, and they're going into a team that likes to blitz a lot, I see a lot of free rushers. I see Brian Hoyer making mistakes, and I see bad things happening. And who even cares what happens on their side of the ball? But yeah, I have the Titans winning. Oh, let's go. 24. No, let's go 17-13. This sounds like a really good, crappy Texans Titans game that we'll see in Pro Football Reference one day. Like, I vaguely remember that.
All right.
And what was your pick again?
31 to
Give me the pick.
24 Texans.
31-24. All right. Well, do you have anything else you want to talk about? Is that all you got for tonight?
I think that's all I got for tonight. We just, oh, by the way, we just got an email from Blog Talk Radio saying that they're having problems with their show starting on time and the music kicking on time and stuff like that. So, hey, thanks, BTR. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Hey, we're in high five now, baby. That's fine. That can happen. We're in high five. Well, thank you again for coming on tonight, and thank you for listening, and thank you for dealing with all the technical difficulties. I'll try to edit it out tomorrow sometime because we have that ability now. And also, if you listen to the show, whether it's live or recorded, and you at least like us somewhat, at least a little bit if you're listening to us. And if that's the case, tell your post office, tell your Walmart cashier, tell your bartender, tell your cousin, tell your ex-girlfriends, tell your ex-husbands, tell whoever that you can that you enjoy Bell Red Radio and that's a fun listen to. And if you go in the city of Houston, you see somebody wearing a Texans hat or a Texans shirt down the street, tell them, hey, you should listen to Bell Red Radio. It's a great show. The guests are very handsome. They're very smart. They're very intelligent. They're very funny. You'll have a great time
Huge
listening to them
dick.
every
Huge
hour
dick.
at huge, huge, enormous. And they go on live every night, Tuesday at 7 p.m. Central. And if you listen to iTunes, go ahead and rate and review us as well. And thank you for coming on again tonight, BFD. I'm Matt Weston, and thanks for listening to Bell Red Radio. We'll be back next Tuesday. Are you going to play some music? Yeah.
Possession. So who taught you the rules? Whoa, we love you blue. You tell me, instant replay, and it just won't be the same. But football teams, not referees, should win the game.
That was I'm Sorry Blue by Debbie Reeves. Good night, everybody.